Good morning. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. It's 4 minutes after 9 a.m. on February 21st. Co-chair Senator Hoffman is not able to attend today due to other commitments. Senator Olson is here, along with Senator Huggins, Senator Thomas, and I will put on the record when the other two members show up. And they were here earlier. We started at the table this morning at 7:30, working on the university's budget. So with us today is going to be four bills, three from the Senate and one from the House. We're going to start with Senate Bill 201, which is public finance website. And then we're going to move on to Senate Bill 122, municipal property tax exemptions. And then on to Senate Bill 204, which is municipal tax exemption for combat deaths. And then the final bill will be House Bill 67, municipal property tax exemptions. So we're going to deal with three municipal property tax bills today. We'll hear all four bills and hold them at the committee for further and review. So again, we will not be taking any action on any of these four bills today. With us is Senator Elton has arrived and Senator Dyson has come into the room. So we have a full committee, not counting Senator Hoffman, which I mentioned earlier, was excused. And we're going to start today with Senate Bill 201, Public Finance Website. I'm going to go ahead and hear from the bill sponsor, who is energetically already jumped in the hot seat. Senator Wilikowski is the prime sponsor. And I'd like him to introduce himself for the record, along with his staff person when she starts in, to bail him out if he steps on his tongue, and walk through the bill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Bill Wilikowski. I'm state senator from Northeast Anchorage, and I'm here with my staff member, Michelle Seidman. And it's a pleasure to be here before you to talk about this bill. SB 201 is the what we've called the Alaska Open Government Act. It mandates a free searchable website that provides Alaskans with easy access to detailed and comprehensive information on state spending. We believe such a website will foster better understanding of state operations. Creation of similar types of websites are occurring all throughout the country. And in fact, in 2006, President Bush signed the Federal Funding Accountability and Transparency Act, which calls for the creation of a searchable website for federal contracts and grants of more than $25,000. You can find that website online at federalspending.gov. I recommend you take a moment to check that out if you're interested. And interestingly, that legislation was introduced several years ago by a bipartisan team of four United States senators, including Senators John McCain and Barack Obama. In 2007, five states, Kansas, Texas, Oklahoma, Minnesota, and Hawaii, passed legislation mandating the creation of online databases with detailed information of their state's expenditures. Efforts are currently underway in 14 other states to pass similar taxpayer transparency acts. When I first learned about this last August at a National Conference of State Legislatures, I thought it was a great idea. I thought it was something that Alaskans would find a useful tool, and we contacted the governor's office about this. I applaud the governor for her commitment to begin implementation of such a system. They've made strides towards that. We've included on your desk, or you'll be getting very shortly, a copy of some documents which have just a couple front pages from the states of Texas, Virginia, and Missouri to show you what those state online websites look like. And when those states have implemented those, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, they've had huge numbers of citizens check into those websites. In fact, I think in Missouri they had over 1 million hits. So it's something that the public has really taken to. We believe it's important to put this in statute because particularly when we look at what's happened every governor comes in and they have different priorities and different suggestions for how to run government. And you'll often see governors overturn what prior governors have done. By putting this in statute, we're enshrining this in law. And it also gives, by having it in statute, this gives the opportunity for the legislature to have a say in what may or may not be in the public website. This bill has a zero fiscal note, and I know that's something that is probably something this committee is very interested in or happy with, perhaps. And I would urge your support of this SB 201. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
I've just got a couple of initial ones. Just on page 3 of the bill, on line 10, it talks about the operative word shall be available to the public on or before October 1st, 09. But I'm under the impression that governors went ahead and worked on this concept, and I'm just wondering why the date is so far pushed into the future.
What happened, actually, Mr. Chair, was we went to the governor's office last August, and we began discussions on this, and they thought it was a good idea at the time, that's actually the timeline that they gave us. As the bill got closer in the prior committee, they really pushed to have it finalized, I think, before the legislature took any action on it. I still think it's important that we do take action on it. And I guess, again, if this committee wishes to change that, I'd certainly be open to that. But one of the things with giving the legislature the opportunity to pass this bill is that we have a say in what can go in and what can't go in. So under our legislature, they'd be required to have the things that we have in this bill up and running. But the reality is, yeah, they do have a website that's up and running. It is a little rough, and I do think it probably could hopefully evolve into something a little bit more polished. And the administration has done a good job of getting something up and running.
Are there initial questions? Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bill, when you look at what the website represents and what your bill calls for, what's the contrast between the two?
I'm going to turn that over to Michelle at this point, so she can give a little bit more in-depth on that.
Senator Huggins, for the chair, my understanding is that right now the website only lists some expenditures, but none of the revenue information called for in this bill. And we do have a representative of the administration here who's in charge of this project who can probably elaborate on that.
Could you identify yourself for the record, please? Maybe just push the mic back just a little bit.
My name is Michelle Seidman, and I'm staff to Senator Wilikowski, and the administration representative that's here today is Kim Garnero, so you might call on her for that information.
We'll bring her up next. We can do that. So, Senator Wilikowski, it looks like a lot of the information in the bill, most of which is already available under just a fragmented view of what we already have. So, does this bill then just direct a cleaner website, so the citizens of the state can refer to one website and get a pretty broad but yet detailed view of the fiscal position of the state?
It does, Mr. Chair, and you're absolutely right. We're not putting anything on there that isn't currently public information. It's just a matter of putting it in one consolidated location where the public can go. All the budget information is public information, but it's currently a very thick document. And it requires a lot of expertise to figure out where it is. And so this would put it on an easy online searchable database.
One of the things we've been working on at the table here, and we'll continue to work on probably over the next couple of years, is to make the budgetary system of the state more easily and accurately interpreted by the public. Right now, the way the system is, it's difficult, unless you're familiar with it, to get a good grasp of what's actually going on. And some of that was intentional for political purposes, and some of it is just an evolution. But anyway, we're in the process of working on cleaning that up. We have Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. One thing that seems to be a problem is for us getting across the point that what the future income to the state is going to be, the forecast. I think a lot of people, you hear what's happening now, they hear about $1.5 billion new dollars from a particular source or something taking place, but there's not that information. Did you consider that might be helpful? Although forecasts are simply what they are, they're forecasts, and they're fairly accurate, they have been. But did you consider that might be helpful for people to see, as well as not just the current transactions that are going on?
Absolutely, and through the chair. There's really no end to what you could put on this website. In fact, if you look at some of what other states are doing, they have a picture of a dollar bill, and they have a breakdown of where all the state's money goes. Some have pie charts. Some have breakdowns by actually the contractors who are getting money. They'll have pie charts that have, for instance, what percentage of money is going towards let's say employee costs, what percentage of money is going towards the various costs that the state incurs, and the same for income, where the money is coming. You could put forecasts on there. I think it really helps give the public a better understanding of where our money is going and where our money comes from.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Senator Dyson, and then Senator Hill.
Yeah, thank you, Chairman. And similarly, I think it would be really useful if the state's outstanding liabilities, were there as well. And I don't know if we ought to add those as amendments, Senator Thomas's idea as amendments here or not, but I think it'd be really helpful for the folks to be able to see. Thank you.
Thank you.
I agree with that. As far as we need to show more than just the asset side.
Yep.
We need to show the liabilities we're dealing with, both long-term and short-term.
Yes, and just further to discussions we've had like this, I would hope that it'd be really clear when we're talking in real dollars or dollars of the day, so that folks can see how greatly the influenced erosion of the value of the dollar is over whatever period we're looking at. I really commend the sponsor for this, and I'm delighted also that this governor's already going for it. And I think it is wise for us to put it in statute so that a less enlightened governor in the future would be forced, hopefully, to continue it.
Thank you.
This bill fits into the same concept of the fiscal framework that we're working on. There'll be several of these that come along that'll be bits and pieces in the mosaic. Senator Elton.
Thank you. And a question that may be better directed to the person from the administration, but on page 2, you talk about what receipts are reported and what expenditures are reported. And one of the frustrations that I've had, and I'm not sure that this bill covers it, so I'll give you the specific, is we collect a lot of dollars through motor vehicle licensing. And yet, I think it's about 3 times the amount that we spend on the agency. But in reading this, we would know what was collected, but under the expenditures part for the preceding month, is it going to be easy to do the expenditures show the disparity between what we collect and what we spend by that agency?
Senator Elton, through the chair, right now this bill would not require that, and I think it would be a good question for the administration about how easy it would be to match those two things together. We're trying to work within the capability of the state's central accounting system so that this isn't an expensive thing or a very expensive thing to do, but that would be interesting to explore with the administration.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any other questions initially for the bill sponsor? Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair.
And I'd like to have a representative from the administration. If you could put yourself on the record, please.
Good morning. My name is Kim Garnero, and I work as the Director of Finance in the Department of Administration. Perhaps I'll try to answer some of the questions that have been directed to the administration. First of all, Senator Elton, through the chair. The relationship of expenditures to funding source is clear in the budget process. It is not as clear in the accounting system. Most appropriations are mixed funded nowadays. They have multiple funding sources. When that's true, it's an allocation process to get to which expenditures were associated with which dollar of collection. It's pretty clear when you're in the federal program area. It's not as clear in other areas when, again, when the appropriations are mixed funded. Trying to do a relationship between what DMV collects and what DMV expends is much more complicated than the version one of the checkbook online we've got out there right now. The differences between the checkbook online that's out on the web at this time and this bill are, as Michelle Seideman said, we don't have all expenditures out there right now. Things that are confidential or may be confidential, which are listed on the website, are eliminated until we can get Department of Law to do an analysis on them. And as the bill recommends, or the bill requires, and we are willing to and interested in doing, aggregating that information going forward, it's just not possible in the current version, but it will be something we, as expenditures are determined to be confidential or not, we'll either be adding the detail or adding the summary information. The revenues aren't there yet. They will be there by the end of this fiscal year. And payroll information. What's making this thing possible is the Alaska Data Enterprise Reporting System, or ALDER, which is the first step in replacing our aging accounting and payroll systems. It's a reporting system, a data warehouse that you appropriated money for 2 years ago, that we are taking our legacy information from our accounting system and putting it into a reporting system that will allow us, when we replace that accounting system, to simply turn it off because we've got that history. The payroll information is not yet in ALDER. It will be by the end of this year for sure. I mean, these things take time. And I would, the payroll information, I believe, was an amendment after the previous committee. We are interested in putting it out there at some level of detail. We don't, that is to be determined. And I think the bill leaves it kind of open. The other thing is the zero fiscal note. I'd like you to put on the record that that is based on the fact that we've used Excel as the tool to meet the requirements on line 5 of page 3, that the database be searchable, extractable, compilable, and aggregatable. And we've had a lot of good feedback from the folks that have used it in the 2 weeks it's been up, 3 weeks it's been up. We've heard from the press, we've heard from the public. It doesn't seem to be an obstacle, the fact that you have to have Excel on your, to do some of the aggregations. And I'd be happy to take any other questions from the committee.
So I'll just go one and then I'll go.
Yeah, no problem.
On the detail, the potential detail that this will have, then you'd be able to type in your boss's name, do a sort on him or her, pull up the salary, benefit levels, and all expenses incurred by them that particular month? Or how detailed will this be?
Mr. Chairman, the payroll information, we are not even at the design stage yet of how detailed it will be. Right now, you can pull up your boss if they've got a travel reimbursement over $1,000 and find them in there, because we do have only payments of $1,000 or more, as the legislation specifies in the checkbook online.
Okay, go ahead, Senator Elton.
Just a quick question. Can the administration track the number of hits like you can on a lot of other websites to determine use?
Senator Elton, through the chair, I'm pretty sure we can. I don't know that we are.
Okay.
And maybe something we should start doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. It appears to me that there may be some wisdom to, let's just take government growth, whatever indicators they are, number of people, positions authorized, and just by year, so you know, people can track, you know, what's happening. I don't know whether that's part of the vision of either the bill sponsor or, in this case, administration to this point.
Well, Senator Huggins, through the chair, that some of that information is in our comprehensive annual financial report, which has been published annually for decades, and it is available on the web. If you look at the statistical information in the back of that audited financial statement, we've got some information about populations and, you know, tracking trends over the years in Alaska, right. Debt load.
Yeah. I guess my thought would be it should be right up front in the macro. And the same thing with operating in the capital budget. Just look at the snapshot of the years and what's the growth or decline and maybe some caveats to what those are so that people can see what's transpiring.
On that subject?
Yeah, go ahead, Senator Geisel.
Yeah, I'm sorry, but it's going to take somebody as clever as you and a lot smarter than me to be able to make sure that the supplemental budgets are there and that they get properly allocated across the calendar year and the fiscal year so that it's easy to see what the total was and also then the shell game that we've often played here of putting capital things in the operating budget and operating things in the capital budget that I think the word is obfuscate. But anyways, it ends up making the analysis, as you've said so accurately, really esoteric, which means known but to a few. And I think what we're after here is to make it clear so it can be known to the many. And if you're able to do that, my hat's off to you.
Senator Dyson, through the chair, that's the beauty of using the state accounting system. It is not driven by which bill authorized the expenditures. It just has the payments. So we get all the payments, capital, operating. We don't sort them for presentation by which budget bill authorized them. Again, we do an annual report of that as part of our comprehensive annual financial report that is online available to people too.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess one of the questions that I have is that it seems like a fair amount of information is going to be compiled, analyzed, or maybe not analyzed, but put together and then put up on a website. But there, I noticed that the last part of the fiscal statement said there's no additional funding needs to be anticipated. You indeed agree with that?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that is my point, that as long as we're using Excel, mm-hmm. We can do this because we're already building the Alaska Data Enterprise Reporting System as the foundation for replacing our accounting system. That's what's allowing us to get data out of our 25-year-old accounting system and into these Excel spreadsheets.
That's impressive. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Then I assume then the public can download it and comment, illuminate it, and grab it with whatever they want to grab it.
Mr. Chairman, yes, I've spoken to several members of the public as they were doing that in the last few weeks, and I will tell you the response is very, people are interested in a lot of different things about the payments the state makes.
So for instance, if I wanted, when this system's up and running, if I wanted to see BP's payments to the state for the month of January, will I be able to go in there and pull up BP and then Conoco and Exxon? Or will I get an aggregate number like I get now when I want that information?
Mr. Chairman, our plan at this time is to present revenues by type, not by source. Revenues are not tracked as elegantly in the state's accounting system as expenditures are. Government's focus is historically on expenditures. Department of Revenue may have that information, and it may or may not be confidential, depending on what kind of payment Conoco is making. But it's not available from the accounting system like that.
So it would be an aggregate then, and then like the fish tax would come up, cigarette tax would come up,
taxes.
I wouldn't be able to go into like the fish tax and see what one of the local seafood processors here in Juneau was involved in the generation of that dollar amount.
Mr. Chairman, that is true. You would not be able to do that.
So the revenue side then would be much blinder than the expense side?
By category, but not by payee, yes.
And then on the detail on the expense side, we'd be able to break it down per individual employee of the state?
And Mr. Chairman, if that employee has received a payment of $1,000 or more, of non-personal services, not payroll, but other payments, reimbursements, travel payments, whatever, they are in there. The payroll information, at what level we present that, is still to be determined.
Just for the public's knowledge, we do get a report that shows a lot of the upper end of the executive branch and the legislative branch, so that information isn't secret or confidential.
And we produce that report, Mr. Chairman, Division of Finance.
Senator Thomas.
Just on that, the $1,000 threshold, that's $1,000 of pay or compensation for travel. You mentioned that. Is that so anytime a person gets a check from the state that's over $1,000, their name would appear? Okay. So basically all employees then in that case, obviously, because they're all going to have an aggregate of more than $1,000.
Well, Senator Thomas, the chair, I don't know that, again, our payroll parameter would be the same as our non-personal services parameter. Well, with the non-personal services, we were just trying to cut the number of vendors down to an amount that could be presented in Excel.
Oh, okay. All right. Okay.
We have one question here. You know, we'll go to Senator Elton. General contractors said maybe they're going to build a building somewhere. Then will the subcontractors be able to log on to a particular spot in the database, pull out any expense over $1,000 paid to a particular contractor, be able to watch the cash payments coming from the state to the general contractor, so the subcontractor then will know when the general contractor receives a payment?
That's true, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. My understanding is, I mean, if I heard you correctly, and it's payments of $1,000 or more, my understanding from that response is that if I travel to Anchorage on business and receive travel expenses of $380, that would not be reported. So there would be no way for somebody to go to the website and find the aggregate amount over the year that probably would be greater than $1,000. There's no way to really, you can see the expensive trips, but there would be no way for a member of the public to determine how many trips were actually taken.
Senator Elton, through the chair. That travel and compensation report for executives that with the Division of Finance puts together is hundreds of man hours to aggregate that trip information from individual paper travel authorizations.
My understanding, and the chair referenced this, is that for state officers and for legislators, that information is already available. So the problem would be just data entry.
It is the aggregation of, it's the manual aggregation of that information for reporting. Okay. It is not retrievable in an automated fashion from the accounting system.
So it may, Mr. Chair, may be helpful for people watching to know that if they want all the detail on travel, they might not be able to go to the website, but they can request that from either the executive or from legislative affairs.
And Senator Elton, through the chair, that travel and compensation report is also available on our division website, the same place that Checkbook
oh,
Online
is.
Okay. Yes.
Thank
and
you,
in
Mr.
the
chair.
Newspapers from time to time.
Yes.
So that's no issues there. From a broader perspective, where do we cross the line of meaningless accounting entry data that really has no validity in the scheme of how we're operating our state versus the aggregate, where we're looking at revenues and expenses and dealing with our long-term debt issues and dealing with our revenue projections, more of the aggregate policy calls versus dropping people down so far into the bowels of the accounting system that they have no clue what we're doing.
Mr. Chairman, I think Checkbook Online is trying to meet the research needs for individuals, members of the press, that have specific questions about payments made to school districts or general contractors or anyone the state's making payments to. I think when you're talking about debt loads and revenue projections, and I would say that our comprehensive annual financial report is a great place to start. It's what the bonding, the debt rating organizations use. The revenue source book from the Department of Revenue, which I'm sure you guys are familiar with. And you know, the budget system itself, your budget system and the executive branch's budget system, produces all kinds of reports that I think help with those more strategic financial planning type of objectives.
Well, I know at this table from time to time when we're dealing with issues, we try to bring in pieces from the financial statements that you just mentioned, which we all get copies of, along with a document we use quite a bit of is the revenue source book, mm-hmm. which is updated twice a year for the public that are watching at home. But, you know, so we try to bring these in to get a feel for where we're actually at and where we're going. One of the things we struggle at this table is from time to time we get people that try to drop us down into the data and send us down a rabbit trail. So we're not dealing with the issue at hand that may give them indigestion. And it's something that we have to, you know, be diligent and pay attention to at this table. I'm not even sure how many people in this building, elected officials or staff, look at that financial report that comes out every year, even though it's delivered to every office. We had a similar issue with the, and there's a lot of information, we had a similar issue with the actuarial reports that were coming into this building, saying that we had a small bonfire down in our basement of our retirement system, and it didn't catch a lot of people's attention until the building was full of flames. Even when the alarm was going off for a couple of years, it didn't raise a lot of concern. I think it has now. So I guess there's two major components that we're dealing with here. One of them is how do you get the information in a website so the average citizen could log on and see where we're at. Physically, you know, are we going into our CBR year after year to balance our budget? And when's it going to run out? Type of information, you know, or and then the other, I guess, the other component is if somebody wants to go in and look at check registers, which really doesn't give you any indication of where we're going, left or right or up or down.
Mr. Chairman, I would recommend if you don't read anything else in the annual financial report, that the management's discussion and analysis, which is at the beginning of that statement, gives a high-level executive overview of the content of the financial statements and the significant events for the year. And again, that's an audited document by your Division of Legislative Audit.
Mm-hmm. In my field, we read that backwards. We start at the back of the book and read the footnotes first. And that's the issue at point. You can get lost very fast, and if you don't go into that book and read the footnotes, they can gloss over stuff.
Right.
With the, you know, on the corporate side, they'll give you the report with all the slick, pretty pictures of all the CEOs and their board of directors. But unless you go to the 10K from the Secure and Exchange, you know, you're reading a marketing document. And my concern is that when we set this up, we have the public has the ability to log on and within a reasonable amount of time, minutes, get a snapshot of where we are physically and where we're headed. I guess it's another issue to to drop them down into the accounting, or they may have an interest in one item, but if they're going to wander around down in there, they'll have no clue for coming or going.
Mr. Chairman, I do think the website has a lot of potential to be built into a communication tool for the citizens about the fiscal health of the state. It certainly isn't at that point right now.
Do we have other questions? Maybe that's something I'll speak with the bill sponsor on when we look at this, so we can try to craft that so it's a useful document to the public and within this building. Because there is a lot of information out there, just a matter of aggregating it and presenting it in all the different multiple publications. We have any other questions for the department? We have several people online. In the off net, we're going to go to Sandra Farbury. If you could put yourself on record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Sandra Farbury, and I am State Government Affairs Manager at Americans for Tax Reform, which is a national taxpayer advocacy organization. And I'm here today to ask a support for Senate Bill 201, sponsored by Senator Bill Wilikowski, and I think you should have our testimonial letter in front of you, so let me just go ahead and make a few points here. In my capacity as State Government Affairs Manager, I have been working with lawmakers and activists around the country on this effort to increase transparency in government spending, and in the process, empowering taxpayers basically to become true fiscal watchdogs. And what my predecessors here have already mentioned, and many members of the committee have mentioned, this is truly about providing taxpayers with a consolidated place to get a well-rounded picture on state government finance, which consumer advocate Ralph Nader, who, as you may or may not know, supports this concept, just like many people on what you would call the right. This is not a left-right issue. It's a right-wrong issue more than anything. But Ralph Nader has said it's the public's right to know, and he has emphasized that information truly is the currency of democracy. And I think that this spending transparency movement can really be summed up in one word, and that is what we're getting at here. That's accountability. Accountability is the cornerstone of the republic in which we live. Transparency, which allows us access to pertinent public information, is the prerequisite for that. And the consent of the governed, from which government is to derive its just powers, is all the more valuable if it is informed consent. Senator Wilikowski has pointed out that this movement transcended party lines at the federal level. This is equally true at the state level. Democrats and Republicans alike support this concept, often unanimous in states where legislation has passed. That was the case in Texas, Oklahoma, Hawaii, just the other day in Washington State. And the public also is very eager to access those websites. Senator Wilikowski mentioned Missouri with millions of people accessing that website. Also, polls reflect that people do want a single searchable website for government expenditures. 73% of Oklahomans supported the creation of the expenditure website leading up to the passage in Oklahoma. And in Maryland, there was just a poll conducted, and it was 82% across party lines that wanted to see a single searchable website put into effect. Now, one thing that I wanted to mention, too, which is a great side effect of this. Now, the main thing, really, this is about access to information, the public's right to know. But there is a nice side effect to this, and that is just something that we're seeing more and more. And that is that these types of websites can actually bring real tangible savings. And I'm not talking about eliminating programs, but I'm talking about squeezing out certain inefficiencies and waste, which even in the best run and most well-intentioned operations simply happen. And the Texas State Comptroller, Susan Combs, told us she used information from her site's web portal to identify $2.3 million in savings in her agency alone. For example, what they found was using that type of information, that they had five different contracts for toner, which were subsequently consolidated into one, saving $73,000. They also decided not to print a study that was already being printed by another agency, to the tune of savings of $250,000. And in Missouri, similar savings have been realized. Now, we may not agree on how taxpayer dollars should be spent. That may be a vast disagreement on that. But I think we can all agree that throwing taxpayer dollars out of the window is not a thing that we want to see happening. And if in the process of making the system more accountable, we can also eliminate some inefficiencies in the process, that's a great thing. Now,
could I get you to sum up, please?
I'm sorry?
Can I get you to sum up, please?
Yes. In closing, let me just reiterate that we believe that Governor Palin has taken a great, and the administration has taken a great first step with the website that they have already put together. We do recommend a few changes and additions, which should be spelled out in our letter to you, but in any case, we do believe that a bill deserves the support, and it should be codified into statute, because this has to be available beyond whoever occupies the executive chambers.
Okay, thank you.
So, thank you so much.
Okay.
And I'll be happy to take questions.
We'd like now to go to Chris Nelson.
Yes, this is Chris Nelson from Alaskans for Tax Reform. I reside at 7702 Boundary in Anchorage, and I'd like to speak in support of this bill. As someone who over the years has searched for state information and that, it's been noted that a lot of this, in fact, almost all of this information is public knowledge now, but you just can't find it in an easy way. I sort of paraphrase the X-Files, you know, the truth is out there, but I bet you can't find it. And by having a single accessible web portal, it's going to be far easier for people to go online, find the information they need. I think this is an important step in the right direction, and I hope the committee considers it, offers whatever amendments you feel appropriate, and moves the bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Meade Treadwell. Mr. Treadwell, are you online? Okay, we lost him. We'll go to Anchorage. Steve Clary.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Can you hear me okay?
We hear you fine. Go ahead and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you. My name is Steve Clary. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Public Interest Research Group, ACPIRG, here to testify as well in favor of SB 201. ACPIRG's been around since 1974, and actually Ralph Nader was one of our founders, so it's nice to hear his name mentioned. But this bill does have a unique ability to unite both and all sides, I should say, of the political spectrum. And for the reasons mentioned earlier, we believe that this is a great bill as well, giving the public knowledge that they need to become active participants in state government. One of the missions of our group is to make sure that and enable citizens to participate in the civic arena, and the pocketbook is definitely one of the quickest and surest ways to do that, and something that interests most people. So we're in full support of this bill. We would also like to give kudos to Governor Palin for getting this ball rolling. But we would like to see this bill pass so that this this trend and this openness continues. It's happened in a lot of other states. It's happening on the federal level. And we see this as a positive way to get people involved in their government and to get them more engaged in the civic arena. And that's it for me. Thanks for the opportunity to testify.
Thank you. That takes care of our off-net and LIOs. Can we have the department come forward again, please? You have a question? One of the issues that we're struggling now is our budget. So under this concept that we're looking at putting forward, would it be easily available then for the citizens, for instance, that just called in, to log on and see the number of employees that are requested to be added to the budget in any particular year, or how many were added to the budget statewide from the previous year or the year before?
Mr. Chairman, that information is not available in our accounting system. Once again, though, I'm feeling pretty confident, although I can't speak to it certainly. I think the number of employees, state employees, is part of that statistical information in the back of our comprehensive annual financial report, which again is on the website. But I will confirm that and write to your staff on that, if that's okay.
Right, yeah, it is available, but it's one of those pieces of information that gets, you know, lost in the abyss of what we work in. But that is one of the, as an example of one of the areas that the public would be able to and easily get a feel for our growth in government. Some of us are rather aghast at the amount of state employees that have been added the last couple of years. In fact, to the point of being darn near breathless. And I think when that information becomes transparent to the public, that would be beneficial to all of us. But we'll be discussing that as we go through the budget cycle here at the table. Do we have, Senator Elton, you had a question?
No, I didn't. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Maybe we can have the bill sponsor come up in summary and wrap up.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess it's just interesting to me how the different political spectrums support this bill. And I think what it really comes down to is in order for a democracy to function properly, the citizenry needs to have access to information. And that's exactly what we're doing with this bill. We're giving average citizens access to information. We're putting it in one simple consolidated area where they can check in. And I think that's a good thing for government. It's proved to be in other states wildly popular, and I would urge your support. If there are suggestions that you have, Mr. Chair, or members of the committee, I'd be happy to entertain those suggestions. You can work with my staff and I and be happy to try to accommodate any suggestions you have.
In my enthusiasm to stay on schedule, I forgot to ask if there's anybody in the room, even though there's nobody signed up. If there's anybody in the room, I see several people that wanted to speak to the bill. Seeing none, we'll get back into sequence here. Do we have any wrap-up questions for the Senator Wilikowski? Thank you, Senator Wilikowski, for coming forward with your concept. It's unfortunate that the enthusiasm of the third floor is kind of ahead of the slower process in the legislature, but we'll work with you to facilitate this matter.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
Thank you. And we're going to set this bill aside, bring it up at a later date. We're going to go on now to Senate Bill 122, Municipal Property Tax Exemption. Again, the next three bills deal with municipal property tax, and I'm sure the taxpayers at home that are listening will be interested in this bill, along with even folks that aren't listening. We have here to present the bill Senator Thomas.
I'll let these guys go ahead.
You can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
My name is Grier Hopkins. I'm staff to Senator Joe Thomas. And with me is Jennifer Uhas, a special assistant to Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor.
Okay.
Senate Bill 122 increases the optional municipal property tax exemption for a private residence from $20,000 up to $100,000. This bill does not mandate any action by municipalities. It only allows local governments the option of increasing their residential property tax exemption. Currently, there are 12 boroughs and 13 cities with a combined population of over 590,000 which levy property taxes. Each of these is attempting to respond to homeowners struggling under the rising cost of energy across the state. In some instances, these issues are coupled with rapidly rising assessed values of private residences. Across the state, these citizens are crying for relief. Senate Bill 122 would not affect a smaller, revenue-strapped community sources of tax income. Instead, it would give those municipalities with large enough population the ability to relieve the tax burden largely borne by homeowners. Senate Bill 122 would allow for local control in setting the allowable exemption at any amount up to $100,000. A local ordinance would then require voter approval before enactment. The original option of exempting up to $20,000 was a good idea when it passed both houses unanimously in 2004 and has been a valuable tool for municipalities which exercise this option. As municipalities around our state attempt to diversify their income base and respond to the needs of private citizens struggling under today's rising energy costs, I urge you to support the timely passage of Senate Bill 122.
So could you give us a rundown on how many municipalities have used the exemption and the $20,000 and what kind of dollar values we're looking at?
Yes, sir. There are currently six municipalities around the state that have enacted varying degrees of the exemption. The North Slope Borough has exempted a flat amount of $20,000 regardless of value of the property. And in 2006, that was valued at just about $1.8 million across the entire borough. The Fairbanks North Star Borough has a 20% assessed exemption up to $20,000 of the property. And in 2006, again, this was about $261.5 million across the entire borough. The municipality of Anchorage has a similar system, except it's 10% up to $20,000 of the property. And again, in 2006, this was at $917 million. The city of Valdez has a 30% assessed value of up to $20,000, and that cost that amount in 2006 again was $9,339,000. The Kenai Peninsula Borough has a similar system as the Fairbanks North Star Borough. It exempts a $20,000 flat exemption. I'm sorry, it's more like the North Slope Borough. $20,000 flat exemption regardless of the cost of the property, and that was $182 million. The Bristol Bay Borough has a flat $100,000 exemption at a cost of $750,000. They all have varying mill rates, but those are the six municipalities around the state that have enacted various versions of the exemption that's currently in place.
If the municipalities want to lower the property tax, why don't they just lower the millage rate? Don't they set that every year?
They do set that every year, but this allows them a more targeted approach to lowering the residential property, lowering their taxes. For the residential homeowners, you can't specify mill rates for different types of property. It has to be one flat rate for the entire borough, and this allows them to more accurately target that how they want.
And has there been, apparently there's been some demand for the increase from 20 to, I think in your bill it's 100?
Yes, sir.
And there, where is the support in the opposition, I guess, to the bill?
Currently we have on record the city and borough of Yakutat supporting the $100,000 exemption, the Anchorage municipality, the Fairbanks borough, and the city of Fairbanks, and Valdez said they would implement the exemption also.
Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I noticed a couple of things in our municipal property tax exemption increase. One of them says Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly has allocated $150,000 to ballot initiative 2008. What's that all about?
I defer to the Fairbanks North Star Borough.
Thanks. Through the chair, that was a ordinance that passed the Fairbanks North Star Borough Assembly. They didn't see motion on the legislation, and they allocated $150,000 to bring a statewide citizens initiative to bring about the change. Should the legislation pass, we'll be able to save $150,000 this year.
Okay, so the initiative is to raise the exemption. Was that what the initiative was?
The initiative would do exactly what this legislation does.
Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. And then on the same page, under other, it says each municipality will have the burden to manage diversification of revenue or retraction of services associated with implementation of an increased exemption. It has three options: reduction of services, decreased budget, shifting tax burdens to non-residential properties, which just gives you the prerogative to do that. Is that
through the chair? Those are examples of ways a municipality may manage the loss of revenue created by allowing the exemption. There was some concern from some of the Senate members that implementing a greater property tax exemption would automatically shift that burden to non-residential property owners. There are other options. A municipality can work with a decreased budget. City of Valdez testified in the last committee that they would not, in fact, be shifting that burden to non-residential property owners, that they have a different system in place than the Fairbanks North Star Borough. So each municipality will have to decide what they're going to do to make up that difference or work with a reduced budget.
Could you please put yourself on the record and maybe pull the mic a little bit closer to?
Yes. For the record, my name is Jennifer Juhas. I am the Special Assistant to Fairbanks North Star Borough Mayor Jim Whitaker.
Follow-up question.
Which brings me to the third item under other is implementing sales, gross receipts, or other taxes. Is this part of a strategy to sell a tax in Fairbanks North Star Borough?
Through the chair, on behalf of the borough, there has not been a strategy outlined to do that. Those are options for a municipality to make up the revenue difference they would be losing. That question was asked by some of the Senate members as I was taking individual meetings.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
So there's no way that the municipalities can relieve the private property owner of this tax burden without this legislation?
Through the chair, we have not been able to find one through our borough attorney or our assessing department or our financial department that would be legal, so no.
We have other questions for the bill sponsor? Okay. Mr. Steve Van Sant, state tax assessor, says here you're open for questions, but I'd like to hear your response on this issue, and I'd like to find out if the administration supports this bill.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Steve Van Sant. I'm the state assessor with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. I don't believe the administration has taken a position on this bill, and like I said, I'm here to answer questions. This bill basically expands the current residential exemption that we have now, which is $20,000. I think we did a fiscal note that said if the bill were implemented in all six places that currently have the exemption now, if they raised to the max of $100,000 without cutting budget, without coming in with other revenue sources, that it has the ability to cost the state about $4 to $5 million by our estimates. And that would be because of North Slope, Fairbanks North Star Borough, the City of Valdez, and the Kenai Peninsula Borough all have vast amounts of oil and gas revenue in them. And if the municipalities were to increase their exemptions up to the $100,000 maximum, they would be forced to increase their mill rates if no other action were taken, which would cause the state to lose money on oil and gas revenues that they currently get to the tune of about $4 or $5 million. That's about it, unless there's any more questions.
Can you repeat that number that the Treasury is going to get hit by?
Through the chair, the estimate we've come up with is between $4 and $5 million that it would cost the state in tax revenue that we're currently receiving from oil and gas revenues.
That's $4 and $5 million?
Yes, between $4 million and $5 million.
Okay. A little different than the fiscal note showing here at $3 million, but either way, it's a fiscal impact to the state. And then, Mr. Van Zandt, can you go over the mandated property tax exemption that the seniors get?
Mr. Chairman, yes, the mandated senior citizen exemption is a $150,000 exemption for all senior citizens who are at least 65 years of age as of January 1 and own and live in their own home. That is a mandate. All municipalities have to follow it. There's also an optional exemption where municipalities may exempt anything over the $150,000 in Title 29, Chapter 45, Section 050, where municipalities may exempt anything over the $150,000. At the present time, we only have one municipality who's done that. The Kenai Peninsula Borough had totally exempted all senior citizen property. They have since reined that in to about $300,000. So it's $150,000 under the mandated exemption and another $150,000 under the optional exemption.
Okay, thank you. Do we have questions for the tax man? Thank you, Mr. Van Zandt, and thank you for the service to the state and helping us keep the coffers full so we could run our schools and our universities, university and other things. I'd like to go now to Tammy Wilson, Fairbanks.
Good morning. Thank you so much for this time to be able to testify. My name is Tammy Wilson, and I'm testifying on my own behalf. I'm from North Pole, Alaska. I just would like you to, you know, support this bill. I appreciate Senator Thomas bringing this up. I just got my tax bill just this last week, and my land and house that I live in went up 63%, which was $20,000 on my land, and my house actually doubled. I live in a 1950 house that's got a trailer as part of my house, and for it to go up this much is just, to me, incredible. In the past 4 years, it's actually increased 95%, and to say the least, my income has not increased that much. This is the only way that the state of Alaska allows a difference between property tax being in those people's homes versus commercial or other properties. It's something that each borough gets to decide whether they want to enact or not, so it's a choice. It's not something that has to be done. It's just sad that although when we looked at our house, we bought it, so we have no mortgage, we will never own our home because of property taxes. And there are people here, and I'm sure all over the state, that with the heating costs, electric, and everything else, is finding it harder and harder to be able to meet these bills, and I would hate to see that people would lose their home over property taxes. And I really encourage you to support this bill. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. We must remember that the citizens have the right to appeal to their council and assembly if they feel their assessments are out of line, and particularly if they're out of line by over 10%.
I have done that.
We have, that concludes our off-nets and the LIOs. We have one participant from the audience who wants to come forward. Gary Zipperman. If you could please identify yourself for the record and speak to the bill, please.
Name is Gary Zipperman. Reside in Nikiski on the Kenai Peninsula. On the Kenai Peninsula. Just for clarification, I think I wrote down there was a assembly member on the Kenai Peninsula Borough. I'm not here speaking on their behalf, as we haven't taken an official stance on either of the property tax bills, the Senate side or the House bill, as of yet. It was my intention to do that in the very near future. Was down here in town with a trade association dealing with our business and noticed that this was up for hearing just by chance in finance. So I appreciate the opportunity to comment on it. Property taxes are something that I've been involved with during my long tenure on the assembly, starting back in the late 90s. This happens to be my last term. I think I've had enough of it. In 2004, we passed a resolution in support of the assembly. At that time, did pass a resolution in support of SB 136, which raised the then $10,000 exemption to $20,000. The initial bill, SB 136, was set at $50,000 at that time, and the Assembly did take a stand at the support of the $50,000 exemption. Since that time, the borough has raised their sales tax from 2% to 3%. We are one of the few municipalities who do have a sales tax system in place to cover any revenue loss from the property tax side if we were to avail ourselves of the increase in the residential property tax exemption up to $100,000. Personally, and I'm only speaking personally, I've had conversations with the administration on the current bill. There's an understanding that maybe $50,000, which, by the way, I'm aware of the House bill has been lowered to $50,000, would be a tool that's necessary for a municipality in our predicament, who does have a very substantial sales tax revenue stream coming in. It's a tool that we would like to avail ourselves of. We can afford it. And when the increase from 2% to 3% was out for the vote last fall throughout the borough, certainly one of the items that came up was what kind of impact is this going to have on our property taxes. So I think it was a big selling point that for us to go more toward a sales tax revenue stream and away from the majority of our revenue stream from the property tax side was the understanding was that we're going to do what we can to give some property tax relief here within the borough. I believe the Kenai Peninsula Borough is really out on point moving more toward a sales tax system. Now, I've listened to a number of conversations in the past, and it's been brought up here today. How is the municipality going to cover that loss? I certainly can't speak for the other ones throughout the state, but we know how we're going to do it. We would really, or I shouldn't say we, I would certainly like to have this tool in our box available so that we can provide property tax relief to homeowners. And I think that's the goal here. Certainly, property taxes has pulled throughout America is one of the most detested taxes in this country. That's always been a part of my focus to try to get some kind of relief going that way. And because of that, I've been a big proponent of sales taxes. So I think that is the sales tax issue is intimately dovetailed with the property tax issue. And if I could, just to make it a suggestion, a concept that has been kind of floating around in my mind, that if you have reservations about this substantial increase in the exemption amount, perhaps you could tie it to some type of sliding scale for a municipality that they can avail themselves of the exemption up to X amount accordingly to what they tax their usage of sales tax within their municipality. I think that would provide not only provide the relief that those municipalities that have sales tax available to their taxpayers, but it was also provide, I think, the necessary impetus for those that don't have sales tax a tool to finally get one in place. And then they could responsibly utilize this exemption.
So are you speaking for yourself as an individual or as a representative?
I am only speaking for myself as an individual on this particular bill, but just as a matter of reference, back in 2004, the Assembly did take a stance on HB 241 and SB 136, which initially that was raising the exemption from 10,000 to 50,000. So just as a point of reference. And we have not, as of yet, taken a stance on SB 122. Haven't had the opportunity. Some of these things down here this session are moving a little faster than I have expected, and it kind of caught me off guard.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our sign-in sheet. Do we have any final questions for the bill sponsor before we set this aside? We're going to go ahead and set this bill aside for now. Move on to the next bill. Next bill is Senate Bill 204, Muni Tax Exemption for Combat Deaths. Again, we're going to hear this bill and set it aside also, but we've had join us Senator Terrio, the prime sponsor of this bill, along with his trusty aide, who I'm sure he's looking forward to introducing for the first time to the Senate Finance Committee, and show him how to work a bill through through the committee process and answer the questions of his colleagues.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, Senator Gene Terrio, Senate District F, and I have with me Ernest Prox, who has been doing the staff work for Senate Bill 204. Senate Bill 204 suggests a property tax relief allowance for widows or widowers of military personnel who were killed in the line of duty in a war situation. In deference to the geographic differences around the state and being protective, wanting to be protective of establishing as much local control as possible, the bill does not set up a mandate, but sets up an option for the local government that they would be able to give a partial or complete property tax exemption. It would be at their discretion. So it wouldn't be something that would be a blanket across the state. If MATSU wanted to give a partial exemption for a period of 10 years, that would be fine. It would be a local decision. Perhaps Fairbanks would want to give a complete exemption for a shorter period of time. Again, their local option. And so it really is just permissive. It, again, is tied to individuals who are serving the United States who are injured and die of an injury within a 90-day period of sustaining that injury or being killed outright during the activities that they were engaged in. I will just to let you know the House version of this bill, they dropped off the 90 days, and so that might be something that the committee wants to consider. And with that, Mr. Chairman, it's pretty straightforward. To just empowers the local governments to shape an exemption if they want to take advantage of it, and to the degree that they want to.
Could you just define for us the permanent place of abode relative to the primary residence and secondary residence, just so it's clear for people at home what we're referring to?
Well, I think that, again, the permanent place of abode would be the place where the person actually lives. You know, it's not their recreational property. And again, I think that there would be enough latitude here in the bill that by ordinance the local governments would be able to shape that the way they want. But if a person owns multiple properties, it would be the suggestion here in the state law is that the exemptions be granted for the property where the person actually lives.
Okay, thank you. Senator Dyson.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Terrio, did you all think about extending this to the veterans who have been so badly wounded and handicapped that they are unable to work, and earn income and or will be paying for lots of care? Has you thought about this?
Senator, through the chair, we currently, of course, have on the books the senior property tax exemption. It's senior property tax and disabled veterans. So most of those veterans are able to get up to the $150,000 exemption under the current law.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Elton, and then Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Terrio, would this leave it up to the option of the municipality or the local government on, when I read the bill, my assumption is that the member of the armed forces does not have to be a resident. A widow or a widower could move to Alaska from Missouri where they had been a resident, and this would the parameters of this bill would allow that person to get the property tax exemption also if there was one that was offered by a municipality, or would it be a municipal option on what widows and widowers would qualify?
Well, again, through the chair, Senator, that I did have some discussions along that line. The way the bill is written now, it would allow a person to move to the state, and if they qualified, were a widow or widower, that were qualified, they would be eligible. And I guess I gave some thought to whether, in fact, we would want to differentiate between, a spouse of an individual that gave their life in the line of duty, just because, did they live here at the time the person sustained the injury or was killed or not? I don't think that many people would be moving to the state of Alaska to take advantage of this. But what you might have is a situation where you had an Alaska resident, perhaps they were stationed in the lower 48, and maybe they're moving back home, really. And would we want to allow them to get the property tax exemption? I don't know that we would want to differentiate and say, well, you weren't living in the state at the time of the death, and so therefore you're excluded.
If I could follow up, Mr. Sure. Chair. Does this mean then that the state mandates that the municipality would have to offer that option to somebody who hadn't been a resident of the state but moved to the state, or would they have the ability to craft their property tax exception based on the criteria that at that point in time they they weren't or had never been a resident of the state?
Senator, through the chair, I think the current wording would mandate that they would offer that. If you wanted to do otherwise, I think you would have to put something in here that would clarify that the person was a resident of the state at the time.
So just to make sure I understand, so it's you're talking about an optional program, but some of the options would maybe be precluded.
Yeah. It's optional as far as what level, for what length, but the prospective pool is mandated.
Yep. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Huggins, and then yep. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend up front, unless the sponsor has any difficulty with it, the 90 days I think is kind of irrelevant. 91 days, 120, I mean, it doesn't matter if a person dies from his injuries. There are some elements that we need to look at the language. I mean, as an example, Alaska technically is considered an overseas tour duty. So we look at any aspects of that. The other one, it talks about permanent place of abode, permanent home of residence, means different things to different people, particularly when it comes to military people and how that applies. And then the next category is single head of household. I mean, you could have a person that has dependents that owns a home here that's neither a widow or a widower, but they in fact have dependents. So they may be majority dependents that live in the home. So that we need to look at how big the umbrella should be in that respect. But in essence, I support the bill. I think it's a great idea, and it's optional. But we just need to make sure language-wise, we look at the scenarios, and I don't know whether have you talked to Jerry Beal about this at all?
No, I do not believe we have.
Yeah, I would recommend you do that, because, I mean, he goes through these kind of scenarios, and he's had some experience with them, and would be important for us in that respect, I think.
I could certainly check with Representative Coghill, and he and his staff may have had contact with Mr. Beal, because they're working the
right
legislation on the House side.
Okay, we'll go to Senator Thomas and Senator Elton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Terrio, I'm assuming lines 11, 12, and 13 are critical sentence indicating that the ordinance would allow the particular entity to pretty much take care of many of the questions that have been asked, regarding whether the person moved into the state but the one that was just previously asked, the permanent place of abode by the resident, That one troubled me a bit. And also, would you anticipate or just assume that that would be another option of the entity, municipality, borough, to whether the person remarried or not, changes statuses such as that? That's something that would be taken into consideration by the borough itself, I would assume.
We had some testimony in the previous committee, and I think Mr. Van Zandt is on the line, that it's my understanding the way that the current mechanism works is when you remarry, you're no longer a widow or widower. That's and correct. So then that that allowance goes away. Certainly as a policy call, that's my understanding that that's the way it works in the current system, in the current law. And I guess I anticipated that that's the way it would work for this one too.
Thank you.
Senator Elman.
Mr. Chair, I was going to ask about the widow-widower, and it's been asked and answered.
Thank you. Senator Terrio, some people, I guess when we look at a primary residence, most people think of a house with a white picket fence or what have you. But some people live in commercial buildings, and that's their primary residence. So would this include commercial property if the person happened to live, primary residence was in one of the downtown buildings or what have you?
Mr. Chairman, I think it would allow enough flexibility that under local ordinance, the local government would be able to say, maybe partition off a certain percentage of the square footage or the residential portion above a warehouse or a gift store and grant the property tax exemption for that component without exempting the business. And I will notice, I believe we got something from the Municipal League that indicated that they were supportive and were supportive of the bill because it did preserve as much local control for the local government to shape this statute through ordinance to, you know, take care of that kind of situation.
And then the number of people as we look today back versus today forward, because we don't know what's coming at us, and hopefully, you know, there wouldn't be a larger demand on this bill for not from a revenue standpoint, but from the family perspective. How many people are we looking at, and where are they in distribution around the state?
Go ahead.
For the record, I'm Ernest Prox with Senator Terrio's office. Mr. Chairman, the last number that I have heard of, it's between 80 to 100 soldiers stationed in Alaska have been killed in combat operations. I don't know how many of those had families and how many have chosen to stay in Alaska. It'd probably be pretty difficult to go back and find out just, you know, where they are all at and if all of them are still in Alaska. I would suspect that the number is not going to be very high at all, though. But that's the number that I've most recently had access to.
So we have 80 to 100 fallen soldiers, and we're not quite sure how many of the families stayed in Alaska, or dependent children, and so on and so forth, or the geographic distribution.
That is correct, Mr. Chairman.
Or whether they had family. They could have been individuals that were not married to.
Okay, we have Senator Thomas and Senator Huggins.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm looking at the line 9, while eligible for hostile fire or imminent danger pay, would that include someone that was killed by friendly fire?
Senator Thomas, through the chair, under the current language, I would I understand that it would include that. There was, in the previous committee hearing, a question if the person had committed suicide, or
right.
would they qualify for the exemption? And I, from the information that I've gotten from Department of Military and Veterans Affairs, the way the military handles it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, if they've intentionally committed suicide, then the military, I guess, they would not qualify for the benefits. However, if they sacrifice themselves to save their fellow comrades, then they are actually bumped up in terms of priority for receiving the benefits. So I know that's just to address that, but also to address your original question, I think they would qualify.
Good. It is rare, but it does happen, and I wouldn't want someone to get canceled out to that. Thank you, though.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's not as rare as you might imagine. I'm just looking at the definition here in Black's Law Dictionary. Is it the intent of the sponsor that if the person remarries that they lose their exemption?
Yes, that it's my understanding the way the current statute interpretation is that then you're no longer a widow or widower, so that exemption would go away. And Mr. Chairman, just in response to the previous question, on line 9, where it says eligible for hostile fire or imminent danger pay, it's not so much an issue of whether you were killed by a hostile fire and whether friendly fire is considered that. It's a determination of the situation you are in. Are you receiving pay for hostile, being in a hostile situation?
I'm hoping. Thank you.
Can I get Senator Ferry, a little bit of clarification? I haven't been in the country, so when I look at imminent danger pay, I don't quite know what that is, but would this cover the soldiers that are like preparing to go to Iraq, as an example, in Alaska in training, and something happens in training and there's an accident and a soldier dies, yet he technically didn't, you know, die in combat, but he was preparing to go and defend his country.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps Senator Huggins can weigh in, but it's my understanding that in that situation, the person who's preparing training in Alaska and is killed would not. I think the imminent danger pay is, when you're on the ground in that particular situation. So when you're over there, where that hostile fire or imminent danger is actually present. And so I would think that if you have somebody and maybe this is where I'm out of my league, if you have somebody in Germany that is working the supply lines and a pallet falls off the forklift and kills them, I don't believe that would qualify because that's not, I would not suspect that that person is receiving imminent danger pay. But again, I may be, or I certainly am outside my area of expertise.
Yeah, we might have to check on that a little bit.
Yeah.
Cooks have value too. And like the supply guys and mm-hmm. or gals. I mean, they're all part of the team. So.
Well, and I would think, Mr. Chairman, that a cook in Iraq is getting that imminent danger pay. The supply sergeant unloading the airplanes is because he's in the area where that situation exists.
Senator Huggins.
Yeah, just for clarification, I mean, it's not a perfect science, but essentially in the combat zone, there's a circle drawn, all right? And the person you described as training, if they were flying in on a C-141 or a DC-7 and they crashed or were shot down once they got into that zone, they would be entitled to imminent danger pay and they would be eligible for this. If they were training at Camp Shelby, they would not be eligible. And there are people that come from Germany, the pilots of military aircraft, they come in and land, they're eligible for the imminent danger pay while they're present. Sometimes it extends for 30 days and it's terminated. So it's kind of when you're within the donut. And it doesn't matter whether you're a cook or a chaplain's helper or the world's meanest machine gunner, you get the imminent danger pay and hostile fire.
Thank you. We have any other questions for the bill presenter before we move on to Fairbanks LIO? Okay, with that, we're going to go to the Fairbanks LIO, Susan Hernandez. You can identify yourself for the record and speak to the bill, please.
Hi, this is Susan Stacy Hernandez. I am the wife of Sergeant Irving Hernandez, Jr., that was killed July 12, 2006 in Iraq.
Okay. want to speak to the bill, we're sorry to hear of your loss.
Thank you. Currently, I can answer on the danger pay. I was listening to everyone's testimony. As far as being a former military spouse, I can answer on the danger pay, how it does work. And I apologize if I am wrong. From being in the military, being a military spouse for so long, I understand how the danger pay works. I can explain it to you if you guys would like. A danger pay is awarded to any soldier. It doesn't matter of their job, whether they're a work for supply, from being in a hostile area, Iraq, Afghanistan, after 31 days of being there, they award a danger pay. That's for any troop that's stationed overseas. That's what danger pay is for. If it's regular training, danger pay is not a part of that. Danger pay is something that they receive only when deployed.
So, Ms. Hernandez, I take it for granted that you're supportive of this bill and would like to move forward?
I am very supportive of the bill, because being a wife of a fallen soldier, I believe that they did serve their time. You know, my husband had served 8 years in the military, and he was planning to make it a career. And being an infantry soldier, you know, he would have retired with some sort of disability. I support the bill because me as a spouse also, I serve my time with him. I have supported his career the whole time he has been gone, from the minute he entered boot camp to the day that his life was taken. I listened to all the testimony today, and for the part about the suicide, I don't believe that they should be allowed this benefit of a soldier that committed suicide, because it was their choice to take their own life. I don't support that if a family member is fighting for this bill if the soldier committed suicide.
Okay, thank you.
Oh, one more thing, sir. I can speak for the families. I have been in contact with several families that were killed here from Fort Wainwright. And most families do move away, with a small percent of soldiers, families deciding to stay here. As far as I know, it's me and one of the spouse that has stood here since the 26 were killed from Fort Wainwright.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony. Do we have any questions for her? Okay. Thank you for your testimony and your service to the country.
Thank you.
We'll go now to Steve Van Zandt, the tax assessor.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Steve Van Zandt, state assessor with Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. And I would just like to answer a couple of questions that were raised. I did go over these with Senator Terrio and be happy to share them with the committee. Permanent place of abode, we have an assessment standard for our senior citizen disabled veteran exemption, which defines permanent place of abode, and the criteria used is 185 days a year. So if a person lives in the residence over 185 days, then that's considered their permanent place of abode. I think there was a question about widower, if the benefits stop when the widow or widower remarries. Under current interpretation of our disabled veteran and senior citizen exemption, if the widow or widower remarries, then that benefit would stop. In conversation with the last committee, it was discussed that if the municipality wanted to extend that past that time, the municipalities could certainly do that. But under current policy, that benefit would stop. I think that answers the questions. Oh, the 90-day issue, the 90 days was shown on line 10, was taken out of the House bill. In conversation with the assessors across the state, we see that as very problematic. I think Senator Huggins mentioned that, you know, whether it's, you know, 90 days, 91, or 120, what difference does that make? And we tend to agree that, number one, trying to keep track of when that actually occurred. So I would hope the committee would take that that 90-day language out of there. Other than that, the municipality does have a lot of control over this exemption, and they can pretty much tailor it to fit their own municipality. So if there's any other questions, I'd be happy to answer them, sir.
Do we have any questions for the tax assessor? Thank you for your information. Do we have anybody from the audience that would like to come forward and speak to this bill? That concludes our offline, online, and audience. And Senator Terrio, in closing, would you like to make some comments before we set this aside?
No, Mr. Chairman. We, you know, we will get in touch with the individual that Senator Huggins had mentioned, and you know, take stock of comments that were brought up today to see, you know, if we can work with your staff on a possible CS, dropping the 90 days out. Originally, both Representative Coghill and myself had it in, because there's the issue of the, is it 90 days or 91 days, but there's also 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. But perhaps, you know, if the policy call is, it doesn't matter if it all stems back to that injury that came in active duty, we should honor the person no matter when. Certainly, you know, I'm fine with making that policy call and dropping that language out. So we'll work with your staff on a possible CS.
Okay, thank you. And you have now had one of your loyal office assistants make his first appearance to the Senate Finance mm-hmm. Committee, and we'll probably see you many times in the future.
Yeah. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, for the opportunity, and hopefully we'll see you again sometime soon. Yeah. Thank
you. Now, do you make copies of these tapes for friends and family back home? Thank you.
We'll go ahead and set this bill aside and bring up the last bill for the day. From our colleagues down the hall, we have House Bill 67, Municipal Property Tax Exemption. And again, we're going to hear this bill, take public testimony, and then set it aside. With us to present the bill is Representative Chenault, and if he could come forward, and Representative Gruenberg. And I'll let the guy on the right or the guy on the left, whoever wants to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I guess I'm going to be the target today in the hot seat. Thank you all for hearing the bill. This is a bill
Could you put yourself on the record, Bill, for us, please?
Sure. I'm Max Gruenberg. I represent House District 20, which is North Central Anchorage, Mountain View, Russian Jack, and Turpin. I'm here with Representative Chenault.
And for the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Representative Chenault. I represent Kenai Peninsula Rural. And thanks for having us in front of your committee, and thank the committee members. Just for a note of reference, earlier I handed out a candy cane. I checked with ethics, it was okay. And it was just decorations.
Okay. This has really blossomed. We put this bill in several times. Section 5, which was the core of the bill initially, we call it the Cop in the Neighborhood Bill. It allows a municipality to provide an exemption from municipal property taxes for peace officers who move into areas that need additional police protection. Because if a policeman or policewoman lives in the area, that is going to be helpful in deterring crime. And that was that optional exemption was the original part of the bill, and subsequently various other provisions have been added. Section 1 was added at the request of the Speaker on the floor of the House. It extends the disabled property property tax exemption for disabled veterans to widows and widowers of those disabled veterans, and that definition is the same definition you've just been dealing with in Senator Terrio's bill. So they too would lose the exemption if they remarry. Section 2 of the bill was added, I believe, by Senator Thomas, and it expands the optional municipal tax exemption for residences from $20,000 to $40,000. Section 3 was added by Representative Meyer, and it originally was a mandatory exemption, and the CNRA committee in the Senate changed that to an optional exemption to allow a municipality to exempt property of a private nonprofit for your college or university that is accredited, that is not subject to the mandatory exemption. But other taxing provisions will continue to apply. And that is important to a facility located currently on the APU campus. And finally, Section 4 was proposed by Representative Olson and Representative Stoltz to allow an optional exemption for a municipality to pass an ordinance to exempt from municipal property taxes property belonging to various religious, charitable, scientific, literary, educational, or fraternal organizations. Many of these facilities, particularly in rural Alaska, are used as meeting places, community halls, and really serve the entire community. And so the bill itself has served as a repository for various reforms for tax relief, in most cases optional property tax relief, for municipalities. And I think it's a good bill, and I hope that you will pass it, because it will provide property tax relief to a wide variety of people and organizations in this state. At least it will let the municipal assemblies do that if they wish. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for the bill sponsor? Senator L.
Thank you. I'm sure this must have come up. Assuming a municipality, especially maybe a small municipality, takes advantage of the options, does it affect the full and true value that is applied to the school funding formula?
Through the chair, I'm not sure that it would. I suppose it could. It could lead to a round of additional assessments. It may trigger the municipality to look at the rest of its taxing structure. But again, it depends upon how much the given exemption will cost the municipality and how much the rest of its tax base is. It would depend upon the circumstance, but to answer your question, it could.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
We have other questions initially for the bill sponsor. Now, let's go to Steve Van Zandt, and if you could give us an idea of what kind of dollars amount we're dealing with here.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Steve Van Zandt, State Assessor with the Department of Commerce, Community, and Economic Development. This bill deals with all optional exemptions, and as such, it has no revenue impact for the state, per se. The one question asked I would like to answer, as far as the full value determination, any optional exemption authorized by a municipality is put back into the full value. So if the municipality's full value is $100 and they exempt optionally some fraternal organization or whatever it may be, the policeman's homes, those are put back in. So the full value will remain $100, even though the local assessed value may be only, say, $85. So the full value won't be affected by that. So for school funding purposes, the four mills will be based on the $100 there rather than the $85. But as far as revenue impact from the state, these are all optional exemptions, so it really doesn't have an effect.
Okay. Thank you for your testimony today. I'm busy.
Oh, Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
One thing I would like to clarify on Section 1. That Section 1 actually doesn't extend that exemption to widowers. It basically clarifies it. The problem with the existing language is it's for senior citizens and disabled veterans. And it lumps both of them in the same category. So a disabled veteran, a widow or widower, would have had to turn 65 in order to take advantage of that exemption. So this Section 1 simply removes that age requirement on that. So a disabled veteran who may be in his 30s or 40s, if he or she were to die, his widow or widower could also take advantage of that exemption. So that's just a clarification on that one, sir.
Yeah, thank you. Do we have any other questions for the bill sponsor?
Mr. Chair, my co-prime sponsor would like to say something that I do support.
Okay, before I ask people from the audience to come up, you can sway them. Representative.
You want me to? Yeah, anyway, Mr. Chairman, I think that Steve Van Zandt did answer the question on the full value of the property, so that was the main thing that I wanted to talk about. I think you also know that we have an amendment there that we'd like to see, and we'll go to that at your leisure.
Okay. And by the way, through the chair, we absolutely have to amend the effective date, because otherwise it would be retroactive, which wouldn't make any sense, too. And I do support Representative Chenault's amendment.
Okay, I'll go ahead and move amendment number one and object for clarification. And I'll ask Representative Chenault to explain amendment number one.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's an amendment that would allow in my case, it would allow my borough to charge cities inside the borough for collecting a tax that is not uniform to the borough. Let's say a particular city has a tax that's higher than the others. And where this came up was that we do have one community that raised their sales tax in their community, and that has caused my borough to have to buy a new program or have their program reprogrammed to allow them to collect that tax. And so they would like to see the option that if they so choose to, that they could charge some type of fee in order to help pay for their software updates.
Do we have questions on the amendment? I'll go ahead and withdraw my objection to the amendment. Do we have objections to the amendment? No objections to the amendment. Amendment number one is adopted. And I don't think there's anybody in the audience here to speak to this bill. And that concludes all the list of the offline and so on and so forth. Do we have any closing comments before we set this aside from the bill sponsors?
No, once again, just thank you.
Okay. Senator Dyson.
Yeah, thank you. Question to you, Mr. Chair. It seems to me that we have an opportunity maybe to combine some of these bills. I just wanted to know if you and your office were thinking about that.
Well, we have, the thought here was to put these bills on the table, get some feedback from the public, feedback from the other senators here at the table, and then draw that conclusion at a later date. I haven't given it much thought at this time.
Yeah. And for the record, I commend your efforts that way, and it does seem to me that they could be pulled together into something that's really even better than the component pieces.
We have, or I did mention earlier on one of the previous bills, it appears that it may fit in one of the, as part of the long-term fiscal structure bill that we're working on. I'm not necessarily thinking of it as an amendment, but part of that concept. Do we have any other questions for the sponsor? Okay, with that, we're going to go ahead and set this bill aside, bring it up at a later date. We have tomorrow at 9 a.m., we have four bills, Senate Bill 230, Film Office, Film Production Tax Credit, Senate Bill 249, Capstone Avionic Loans, Fund Loans, House Bill 61, Tax Credit for Contributions to Votech Ed, House Bill 266, Repeal, Termination of STEP Program. We're going to, tomorrow morning, take up Senate Bill 249, the Capstone Avionics Fund Loans first, as there's quite a setup for them. They want to try to demonstrate that program to us on the screen. So we're going to facilitate them at 9 a.m., and then we'll follow down the list tomorrow. So we'll see everybody here at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Meeting adjourned.